Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Dora Harberson, and I am a very grateful and enthusiastic member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. Hi, everybody. I am very, very grateful to be here at Monteagle this weekend and to be sharing with you. I would like to thank the Monteagle Committee for placing a telephone call to me and asking me if I would come and share with you, because it is a great honor to be standing behind this podium today to share my experience and my strength and to give away my hope to you all. As I said, my name is Dora Harberson. I am a member of the New Warrington Al-Anon Family Group in Pensacola, Florida. And in my heart and in my mind and in my spirit and soul, they are the very best Al-Anon group in this whole wide world fellowship. And someone shaking their head, no, and I disagree, but we disagree agreeably. So I wanted you to know that I do have a home group. And in our One Day at a Time book, there is a very short prayer that I found many years ago when I came into Al-Anon, and it said, God guide my thoughts and let these guide my actions. So every time I speak behind a podium, I adapt that prayer to say, God guide my thoughts and let these guide my words. Because I want you to know that I never know what talk I'll give. It's never the same ever. The only thing the same about it is I still have the same name and I still have the same home group. And beyond that, if I will do a third step, God will take over and you'll hear what he would like you to hear. So I do know my name and I know my home group, and I've said my prayer. I would like to tell you that I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was born into a family that wanted a child very much. So when I came into the world, I was a loved and wanted little girl. And my mother shared with me when I was very small that she had always wanted a little redhead, and that is what God gave to her, so he answered her prayers. So I have been a redhead all my life, and don't know how much longer I will be, but as long as God will let me have some control over it, it'll be a while, because I have found out that I also agreeably disagree that blondes have more fun, because no one on the face of this earth could have more fun than me with my red hair. And so I love being a redhead, but my mother wanted that, and that's what God graced her with. When I was a very small child, my mother became ill with a disease, and very quickly it crippled her, and she became an invalid. And when that happened, we had to move from Little Rock into the home with my grandparents in the country in a very small town called Waldron, Arkansas, that I am sure no one in this room has ever heard of. Yes, one person has, at least. It is in Scott County, Arkansas. And so I was primarily raised in a little country town, very small, less than 3,000 people. And I was raised on a 13-acre farm in an old farmhouse, and I was the only child in that farmhouse. When we moved in with my grandparents, it was so that my mother could have care and be taken care of, and also it was so that her child could have care. And if anyone had ever asked me what kind of childhood I had, I would have told you it was wonderful. It was an ordinary childhood, and that's how I felt all my life. Looking back, I realized it was not ordinary, because I was, the child of an invalid mother who was incapable of doing the things a mother does with a little girl. But I never knew that, because we were a clannish family, and the aunts and the uncles all pitched in to make sure that I never felt different or deprived or in any way different from any other little girl. So I have never felt like I was not taken care of, because I was, and my father loved me beyond belief. He loved children, and he loved me. Alcoholism, I never knew that word alcoholism. I never heard the word alcoholic until I came to Al-Anon 15 years ago, and that's how long I've been here, since 1984. But that was my first time to hear the word, but yet abusive, addictive drinking was in my life when I was born, and when we moved to this little small town, Across a field from me lived my very favorite uncle and my aunt that took care of me more than anyone else, and I loved that family. And they had a child that was 9 months older than me, so I had a little girl to play with as I grew up. I adored my uncle. I just adored him. But every once in a while, strange things would happen in his home that I didn't understand. I was too little to understand, but I knew that the family members got really upset about his behavior and his actions. And he got real loud and noisy, and he did crazy, crazy things, and people worried about him a lot. I did not know at that time that it was because he was a periodic drinker, and this was one of those periods that would come along when all of a sudden there would be a lot of noise from over there, and then the family members would all leave and leave him alone, and then in my household across the field, a lot of gossiping and criticizing would go on about my aunt and the fact that she had left him. She left him over there all by himself, and bad things could happen to him. And bad things did happen to him, a lot of them. But I hated that they talked about my aunt that way because of my love for her. And I hated it when they took my cousin away because there went my little playmate. So I didn't understand at first what was going on, but as I got older, I did. And as I got older, it began to bother me also, because I began to put together that once this started across that field, it always ended in some kind of a disaster, and they were never pleasant. My uncle had more accidents, and he had more car wrecks, and he just had really bad things happen to him as a result of the periodic drinking. And once he started, the one thing I did as I grew older learn is when he started, he could not stop. I did have enough knowledge to know that, and it was going to take a really major thing to put an end to it, and a real major thing to bring the family back home. One of his fun things that he did, and I enjoyed the comment this morning, there's a dog somewhere around here that's barking, because one of the fun things that he did that he liked to do is he was a hunter, so his home was full of guns, and his guns were never removed from him. So when he would get drunk, one of the first clues we had would be that all of us would be in bed asleep, sound asleep, and about 11 or 11:30 we would hear these gunshots going off, followed by every dog within 3 miles barking their heads off. And it would be my uncle, and he was just walking up and down the road shooting his shotgun, you know. I just thought he would do that for whatever the reason, but everybody who had a dog, their dogs were yapping and yipping and barking, and that was the end of a good night's sleep for anybody within a mile of him. And he was so loved by this little town, though. He was an attorney, and in his good days, he was a very good attorney. He just wasn't dependable, because your court date could come due, and he wouldn't be there. But the county sheriff would not lock him up. They would come out, and they would get him back in his house, and they would talk to him. But they wouldn't lock him up, so he didn't have to go spend very many nights in jail. Once in a while, they took him there for his own protection, but that was rare. But anyway, I learned not to be very happy when these circumstances would start, because they were bad. And I also learned to have a fear of alcohol and drinking. And as I got a little older, and I got to be 8, 9, and 10, somewhere along in there, over a weekend, there was a Saturday morning that I was taking a slow, leisurely bath in the bathtub, and I had laid my little soapy washcloth on the side of the tub, and it slipped over between the crack of the tub and the wall, and I leaned over to get my washcloth, and when I did, I looked down, and here was this little bottle, just about that tall, with brown liquid in it. Now, I have to tell you, I have always been and will die being curious. I've got to know about everything. I have to know. My daughter says when I die, on my epitaph and my headstone, they're going to say, "She now knows," because I have to know. I picked up this little small bottle. Me sitting in the bathtub, I picked up this little small bottle, I unscrewed the lid, and I smelled it, and oh my, it smelled horrible, horrible. My eyes even watered from the smell, but that wasn't enough. I had to go ahead and see what it was. So I did taste it, and I'm here to tell you people out there, I don't qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous because I hated it. It didn't taste like Coca-Cola, not at all. It was whiskey, and it did not taste like a Coke to me. I could not get out of that tub and get dried and enclosed fast enough to go to my mother. My mother was the one person in my life that would never lie to me, never. She would have never told me a lie, no matter how painful for her. So I went straight to her and told her what I had found. And see, I knew it did not belong to my uncle. He never brought his liquor into our home. I knew it didn't belong to my grandfather. He wouldn't do it. He was a judge, and he wouldn't do that. And by gosh, it couldn't belong to my dad because he was my idol, and he wouldn't drink that nasty stuff that caused so much trouble. So I went to my mom, and I told her what I had found, and for the first time ever in my life, she did not give me a straightforward answer. Now, she didn't lie to me, but she just didn't give me a straightforward answer. Her remark to me at that time, and I think I was 9 and could have been 10, but her remark was, "Don't ever mess with those bottles again. Don't ever tell anybody you found it or saw it. You leave it alone and you forget it." Well, forget it was not in the question. I could leave it alone and I could never touch it again. I could not forget it. Again, my curiosity, I have to know who's drinking from this bottle. Who does that belong to? And that didn't take me long. Took me just a few hours to watch that bathroom door and see who went there often. And lo and behold, it was my dad. And he would go there every 2 to 3 hours and he would drink out of that bottle. Now that I know it's there, I follow behind him like a puppy dog. And when he goes and comes out, I go and I look and see how much he drank. And, you know, I did that for 6 years. I did it for 6 solid years. And I've got to tell you, I saw bottles with just a little bit in it. And then I saw the full one appear. And then I saw them go down again. But, you know, I never saw where the empty bottles went. They never went in the trash can. They never went in the garbage. What I know happened today, though, is our bathroom was built on many years after the home, and it was a remote outside bathroom, and he would walk out on the porch and sling his bottles out into the field behind us. Years and years later, when that home was torn down and a business was put up on it, don't you know they had fun out there with those bulldozers running over those hundreds of bottles that he slung out there all those years? And I never found those empty bottles out there. But anyway, I did watch him, and I did see who the drinker was. And then I knew. And then I knew that he was drinking. Now, he was not drinking like my uncle. He was drinking all day and into the evening until he went to bed at night, around the clock. However, he was not a loud drunk. He was not a mean drunk. When he drank, he got more humorous. He got more lovable. He never stopped being the dad to me that he was, and he was never incapable of being a loving father, but I was scared because I would look across the field 5 and 6 times a year and see total family disruption over there because of alcohol, and then I would realize, I have the same thing here in my house. It's just acting out differently. But you see, now I had a secret that I carried with me all those years, and I became an obsessive bottle watcher. I hated that my father drank because I didn't want anything bad to happen to him. I have seen my uncle in really sad situations. I have seen him with cuts and with stitches and with casts and with wrecked cars, and I've seen him hurt and throwing up and not able to eat, and I did not want that for my dad. By the grace of a loving God who is my higher power, I never saw that with my father. I grew up in that home, and I had friends, and I spent nights with friends, and they spent nights with me. And we lived in a dry county, so I didn't know of anybody else other than my cousin that had anyone drinking in their family. So I couldn't talk to any friends because they didn't have that in their home, and I did, and my mother had said, "Don't tell anybody." So I had to keep that because she'd asked me not to tell anyone. As I grew up into a young teenager in that dry county, I can now remember times that I went to a bootlegger's home, but I didn't know that's what I was doing. On Sunday afternoons, I guess my dad really couldn't or didn't stock up enough to get through Saturday to Monday. So on Sundays, he would say to me, "Let's go for a ride in the car." And oh man, I'd have gone anywhere with him. I just loved him. So we would take off and we always went the same route though. And we would go out of town and there was this house on a hill and he would pull up in there and he'd say, "Now you sit right here. I won't be but 10 minutes, but I want to go in and say hi to my friend." And he would leave and he would go in the house and he would come out with this brown paper bag. And you know, I thought his friend had given him something. Well, man, they had. And, you know, we'd go ride some more out in the countryside, and then we'd come home, and then that bottle would appear full in the bathroom where I went and checked to be sure. So I went to bootleggers' homes and didn't know that's what I was doing, and that's how he would get through his weekends. I got to be 14, 15, 16, and I was doing what high school people do. You know, I was in high school having fun, doing everything. And I got to tell you, about 15 years old, I had my first boyfriend, and I don't tell this to offend anybody. Please don't take offense, but I am going to tell you, my first boyfriend lived way out in the country, and he was a country boy. But he liked me, and he paid attention to me, and that made me feel important. So he was taking me to Saturday movies, and we would sit in the movie, and he would put his arm around my shoulder, and he had body odor, and I would try not to breathe for like 2 hours. And this is where I don't want to offend anybody, but I would try not to breathe for 2 hours. But, you know, I wouldn't think about breaking up with him because he paid attention to me. That was my first boyfriend at 15. At 16, there was another really popular, and I found out why quick, boy that hadn't paid any attention to me that all of a sudden did one day, and he asked me for a date, and I thought, wow, you know, all the girls are after him, and he's after all them, and he's asked me, of course I'm going with him. So he came to my home, and he picked me up in his car, and I was 16, and he took me. We were to go to the movies, and on the way to the movies, we passed the theater, but we kept going out of town in this car, and I began to get real scared and suspicious, and I said, "Why did we not stop at the theater? Aren't we going to the movies?" And he said, "Later." And I thought, oh gosh, and we're going way out of town. Now, most of you won't know what a pole yard is, but there was a pole yard outside of town where they peeled poles, you know, to make utility posts and all that. Well, that was the makeout place for town, and I had never been in a pole yard. I'd never wanted to be in a pole yard, but I was going to one whether I liked it or not because the car was going there. And I got really frightened. So we pull into the pole yard, and he finds his little lane he wants to go down, and he stops the car and looks at me, and I burst out crying, and I said, "You take me home, and you take me home now." And he said, "Will you cry, baby? I will." And man, he backed out and spun out, and we got back to my house, and he let me out of the car and get me in the house, and my mother was suspicious, and she called me over to the bed, and she said, "What happened?" And I told her, and she said, "Don't tell your dad." She said, "If you tell your dad, he may try to kill that guy." And you know, he might have, because I was his treasure. And of course, that guy never even kissed me. We didn't get that far. He took this crybaby home. Now, that's my second and only boyfriend I ever had in my life until I was 17. I want to tell you real quickly, at age 16, my father committed suicide. I didn't know why. We had no warning it was going to happen. It was a total, complete, utter shock to me and to my family. But it devastated me because prior to that time, though I knew he drank out of that little bottle, I loved my dad. And he was the one that fished with me. He taught me to fish and he taught me to hunt. He taught me to ride a bicycle, to play basketball, softball. He went to all the things that parents go to with children, and he filled in for my mother, and at my age of 16, he committed suicide, and he shot and killed himself. And I was the first person in the family that was told that because of my mother's illness. They would not go to her first. They came to me at school and shocked me to death, and all I could think of was, "Please take me to my uncle's law office." That's all I could think. And thank you, God, my uncle was sober, because the chances of that would have been either way, but he was sober. And I never had to deal with anything else beyond that, because he went to my mother with the news, and from then on it was out of my hands, and there was a funeral, and in me there was a void so big in my life because my father was gone. And so from 16 to 17, I walked around and went on to high school, became a senior, but I was sad, and I was lonely, and I was mixed up, and I was hurting, and I was extremely confused. And I became 17 in June. One day I decided I wanted to go into town, and I always walked. It was about 3 miles, and I would always walk to town. That Saturday, I just wanted to go to town just to get away from the house, and I was just really sad. And I went into town, and I passed by this dry goods department store, and in there was a lady I loved. I had known her all my life. She had 5 sons, and I knew 3 of them, but I didn't know the 2 oldest ones. And I walked past her window of her department store that day, and I usually always went in to talk to her and to hug her. And she loved me, and I knew that. So I looked in there, and man, she was talking to this young man, and he was so handsome. Oh, he was so handsome. And I looked in that window, and if I could have gone through the glass shorter than the door, I think that's what I would have done. I wanted to see who in this world that was with her. So I go in there as quick as I can get through the door, and of course, she's motioning, come on in. So I go in, and she introduces me to her next to the oldest son, and oh, he was so good looking. And I was 17, and he was an older man of 24. And we talked a little while in the store, and he said, would you like to go next door to the drugstore for a Coke? Man, that sounded good. If he had said strychnine, I'd have said yes. I just wouldn't have drank it. So he took me next door, and we sat in a booth, and I looked across that booth at this man, and he was suave. Now, what would I know about that word? He was sophisticated. He was older. He smoked cigarettes, and he ordered coffee. Now, if I had known then what I know today, that would have been my clue. He smoked, and he drank coffee. He qualified for AA. We just didn't have the alcohol at that time. And I have to tell you, I fell in love with him across that booth that day. I mean, I did not fall in lust with him. I fell in love with him across that booth that day. So he drove me home. I didn't have to walk back my 3 miles. And the next day he called, and we went to one of his younger brother's ball games. And we dated the rest of that week. But I found out he was in the Air Force in Louisiana. So we could, you know, he was going to go back to Lake Charles, Louisiana, which he did. But he wrote to me, and he called me, and he came back home about every 3 weeks or so for a weekend, and we continued to be together and date. And at the end of 3 months, he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. I knew I was in love, and I said yes. We had to go to my mother because I was underage, and immediately she gave us permission because she had been with him and met him, and she adored him, and she saw him as someone who would pick up and take care of her daughter in case she were not around much longer. And so she said yes, and we got married 3 months after we met, and we had not been together much during those 3 months because he was gone and off to Louisiana. But we got married, and I listened last night to our speaker talk about the kind of wife and home person and mother. I knew absolutely nothing about being married. I had never cooked. I had never cleaned. I had never done laundry. All that had been done by a housekeeper who was also a nurse to my mother. So when I got married, I didn't know what it meant to be a wife at all. I had no idea of a responsibility. But he knew that also, and he knew what he was getting, and he knew that he was getting an immature person. I'd had 2 boyfriends prior to him, and he knew he was getting, you know, this person that just popped out of this egg. And so now today he looks at me and he says, what she is, I made her because I raised her. So now he has to take blame for the bad stuff, and I take credit. I give Al-Anon credit for the good. We got married and we set about our life of living, and there was no drinking, absolutely no drinking, for a lot of years in this marriage. Now, what we were trying to do, self-will, is I wanted to be a mother, and we were trying to have children. We wanted children desperately because I love children, and so did he. So we were trying to have a family, and that was not happening. And in the meantime, we were just doing all this fun stuff together without any drinking, so I had no reason to fear of anything. And 9.5 years in the marriage, there still weren't any children, and this was not what we wanted at all. So we were dealing with a physician who finally just sat us down one day and said, look, years are passing, and we're 9.5 years in this happy marriage now. And he said, if I know you genuinely do want children, but it looks like there is another plan for you. Consider adoption. Well, by golly, we did. We wanted to be a family that would just have made that perfect picture. So after he told us that, we set about adoption. It took us 2 years to get our first baby, and that baby was a gift from God. We asked for, and we said, we'll wait for a little boy because we wanted a son first. So we waited 2 years, and now we're like 11 years in the marriage, and we get our first child, the gift from God. We got a blonde-haired, blue-eyed baby boy who is now 33 years old and lives in Pensacola, Florida, and the father of my 3 grandchildren. We waited 4 years, and we wanted a daughter to go with this son, and we're still moving into this marriage with no drinking. So God again gave us another precious gift. He gave us a red-headed, blue-eyed, beautiful daughter who is now 29 and lives in Japan. So we had 2, and we thought, okay, now at our age, we had always said 3, but we said, we're stopping here. So we had 2 children, and we had dogs, and we had cars, and we had our first home, and we had a life. And I was in heaven. I mean, I had everything my heart could desire and no drinking. And then my mother died, and I had cared for her as best I could all my growing up years. And when she died, I once again felt to the degree I did when my father died. And my husband being, and he is, a very sensitive person to me, knew that I was struggling with the loss of my mother. So he said, let's go on our first vacation that we had ever taken as a family away from Arkansas. He said, let's go to Florida. So we had friends in Pensacola. And we called them, and they set it up for us to come for a 2-week vacation in Pensacola, Florida. We did that. We fell absolutely madly in love with the state, and we had no reason not to leave Arkansas and come to live in Pensacola. And so I was sharing yesterday, talk about impulsive. Within the time we left from our vacation and was back living in Pensacola was 1 month. And here we were, 2 children and dogs and all that. And we had a home, a beautiful home we had built for our specifications exactly like we wanted it in Arkansas. We had been in it about 1.5 years. It was on the market and sold, and here we were in Pensacola, Florida. Now talk about life change. But when we went on that vacation and we arrived at our friend's house, knocked on the door, they came to the door, the man invited us in, and as we were walking into the kitchen, he said to my husband, Bill, would you like a cold beer? And he said, yeah. And right then, my fear flooded over me 100% because he said yes. And I saw him drink a beer out of a frosted mug, and I hated it. And so when we left their house, I started what was going to be my history for years, the battle against alcohol. I fussed, and I pitched a fit, and I told him, don't ever do that again. Well, I'm in Al-Anon, so that tells you how powerful that statement was. Don't ever do that again. Well, he did it again and again and again and again, and lots of more times after that. But it started simply with an offer of an ice-cold beer in a frosted mug in our friend's home. We went to dinner that night, and there was beer on the table. So for 2 weeks, anytime we were with them, there was drinking, and to my disappointment, he drank. Now, he did not abuse it, and he did not show any signs of it, but he drank, and that was enough for me. It was enough to strike the chord of fear in me. I don't want this in my life. But when we moved to Pensacola, that's what I got. It was a package deal. When we got there, our whole lifestyle changed. He was working as civil service with the Navy base, and our life there was, you work Monday through Friday, and boy, on Friday afternoon, you cut loose and you party Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and you go back to work Monday. Now, that's how it was supposed to be. And I balked at that, so I became a witch with the B in front of the W about the drinking. It just wasn't going to be. Now, we could go party with them, but we weren't going to drink. Well, I didn't, but he did. And so he did start socially drinking with friends, and then as his job progressed and he went up that ladder that sometimes you go up, it, quote unquote, the way it was put to me, became expected that he drank. And so it was expected. And it was expected that I'd go along, and they were hoping I would. And I am here to tell you, it's a wonder that I don't belong to Alcoholics Anonymous, because the waitress we had where we partied tried every way in face of this earth to find a drink that I would like. And so she would bring me the samples of all the beautiful drinks they make, and none of them would be what I wanted. Nothing tastes like Coca-Cola, nothing. So they were never successful in finding me a drink, but my husband was drinking, and he has an AA story, and you don't want to hear it from me, but his drinking progressed, and I could see it happening, and I know how I was behaving, and I was saying, if you love me this weekend, you won't do that. Because you love me, you won't do that. And you know I don't like it. And you know what happened to my father. And by this time, my uncle was dead of alcoholism. He died of double pneumonia drunk. And so I would say to, you know, I lost my dad. You know, I lost my Uncle Brian. Now, you won't do this. Well, of course he did. And I didn't know that he couldn't not do it, because somewhere through there, it stopped being social and it became something else. So eventually, I couldn't avoid it anymore, and I started seeing it for what it was, and it started driving me crazy, and I changed, and I was no longer the loving wife I wanted to be or the kind and gentle mother. There was nothing kind and gentle about me when I saw the drinking was there and it wasn't going away. I motivated on pure fear and on self-determination of, I can stop this. I can argue him out of it. I can beg him out of it. I can love him out of it, or I cannot love him out of it. But I can stop it. And I was fighting a disease that I did not stop. And eventually, my behavior got very unruly and very unladylike, and I didn't like me any longer. And I knew why. So one day I decided in my mind, I'm going to give this up. I'm not winning. So I'm going to give it up. And what I'll do is I'll pretend it's not happening. So I'll just pretend there's no drinking. So I quit even looking at him. And I would look elsewhere. And what I did at that point is where I became the not so good mother. I looked at my children, and they were teenagers. And I started watching their every move, trying to be in charge of their every move, tried to tell them who their friends could be, couldn't be, where they could go, where they couldn't go, what time they could leave, what time they would be home. And they didn't like me anymore. And they didn't want to spend time with me anymore. And our home divided. And it got to be where my husband would come home from work and go in the bedroom, and I thought he was resting, but he was passed out. I didn't know that, because I didn't know about passed out. But he would lay across the bed for 2.5 hours and then get up and come back into the family. But my children would each go in their own room, shut their doors, turn on stereos, and get on the phone or get out books. They wouldn't spend time with me. Nobody spent time with me, and I don't blame them, because I didn't want to spend time with me. And I went into denial of drinking as a problem, because I couldn't do anything about it, and I stayed there for 5 years. And I tell you that my loving God let me stay there for 5 years, because I would have wrecked a marriage real quick. If I had really focused on it and continued to fight it, I would have wrecked a marriage. I did not do that. So my God, and only my God, let me wear blinders and ignore the problem, and did allow the problem to proceed on till it got to where it got. And that's what I want to share about now, is there came a day in our life that was no different than any other day in the world. My husband got up and went to his prestigious job, dressed in his suit and his leather shoes, and man, he looked nice, and he had his briefcase that he was never without. And I know today, because it was what was in that briefcase. He was never without it, never. So he went to work. My children went to high school. And I don't know what I did that day, and it's not important. I existed. I didn't live that day. I didn't enjoy life that day, but I existed till the afternoon. My children came home, went to their rooms. My husband came home, took a nap on the bed. And I was standing in the kitchen, and in sanity, I was thinking, now what kind of delicious dinner can I fix for this loving family tonight that we can all sit down to the table and eat? We had not sat down at a table and had a meal in years. The children would go to the freezer and the microwave. He would go to the pantry and make a sandwich, and I would get whatever. And I weighed about 105 pounds at that time. But I was planning this wonderful dinner. What could it be? And I'm standing in the kitchen with just me, and in my head, and this is how today my higher power talks to me, even today, is the thought came into my head, and the thought said, you know, if you just stepped outside this door into the garage, which is where he stays all the time, if you just stepped out there and looked around for a minute, and I thought, why would I go in the garage? I never did. When he went in the garage, I didn't go. He was a smoker, and he said he was smoking in the garage for my health's sake, and he didn't want me to, you know, to have secondhand smoke. I would never follow him, never. So I thought, why would I want to go out there? But I did, and I'm glad I did. I walked out, and here was his fishing boat, because my husband is a fisherman. Today, there's a boat in my garage today. Today, the boat doesn't have in it what it had that day. I hope. I wouldn't know, because I haven't looked. But anyway, I walked out, and here was this boat, and I saw compartments. You know, boats have compartments where you put stuff in, like life jackets and fishing rods and all that good stuff you have to carry around, vina sausages and stuff like that. And for some reason, I saw the latch. And here again, the thought said, open up the boat. Open it up. So I turned the latch. I picked it up, and I raised up and looked in. Here was a big bottle. It wasn't a little bottle. It was a big bottle. And I froze, and I picked up that bottle. And the boat was at an angle, and it still is today. And when I picked up that bottle, another one rolled down. And I picked it up, and here came another one. Now, I did that, and this is an honest program, and I'm telling you the truth. I ended up pulling out about 20, between 20 and 30 bottles, because later when he could share with me and we could talk, he said he hadn't had a chance to make the run to a dumpster. So I found the empties, and man, I got furious, and I lined them up in the bottom of that boat, and I ended up with like my 20 to 30 bottles. And then clarity hit me. Oh my gosh, the children are home and they could walk out here, which was not likely because they weren't coming out of their room, but I was afraid they would see what I had found. So I got a leaf bag and I put all those bottles in the leaf bag, walked around the side of the boat and put them where they couldn't find the bag. And then I realized how mad I was, and I am a redhead, and I have a temper, and by the grace of God, today I don't show it to you, but I showed it to him. I went flying back in that house, and I was going to make as much noise as I could, so I was stomping down the hot carpeted hall. He couldn't even hear me coming. Stormed into that bedroom, and I opened that door, and when I did, I mean, I was ready. I was going to let him have it, and it was stopping now, and that was the end of it. And when I flew in that room so angry, he was sitting up on the side of the bed, and he had his head in his hands, and I stopped because that scared me. And I looked at him, and he raised his head, and then I got mad again for an instant, and I said, I have got to talk to you. And he said, no, wait, I have to talk to you about my drinking. And there it was, and there went my blinders. They just fell off into the floor, and I couldn't stand the pain. I couldn't stand the pain, and I started crying. And I looked at him, and he was crying, and we cried together because, let me tell you, folks, it takes a lot to make this man I'm married to cry, and he cried. And I cried, and I was scared. And I said a prayer then that I will say every day of my life from now on, and it is three words. Only then it went, God help us. Now it's God help me, or God help Barry, or Krista, my children, or you. But it was God help us. And I went to him, and I held his head to my bosom, and he cried, and I cried, and I knew that, I just knew we were just doomed. Because here it was, and what do? We didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, we didn't know, Al-Anon, treatment centers, we didn't. I just was struck helpless, and that's our first step, powerless. But he said to me, I'm going to do something, but it's going to take me 2 days, and I've got to drink in those 2 days. So you're going to see me drink. But in 2 days, I'm going to do something about this problem. And he couldn't do it before the 2 days. So I took a breath, and I thought, well, it'll never work, because I know where alcohol ism leads, and I'm going to lose him, and he's going to die, and we've been married 26 and a half years at this point. 26 and a half years, and we won't see the year 27 in a marriage because he's going to die. I've lost my other two. He'll die. But anyway, I had said, God help us, and God did. 2 days later, my husband took his last drink in the kitchen of our home, walked over to the sink and poured the remainder of this tall bottle that now I was very familiar with down the sink, and I drove him to a place in Pensacola. He would not let me go in, which we found out later could have been a mistake. He didn't let me go in. He got out, and he said to me as he left, which terrified me, if this doesn't work, I'm not coming back. I won't bring this back to our home if this does not work, and I don't know if it's going to work or not. And he got out of the car with his bag, and he walked up some stairs, and I did not see him again, nor did I hear from him for almost 4 days. Now, I didn't know if he stayed or left. I didn't know what happened. They wouldn't let him call me, and I hadn't gone in, so I didn't know, you know, that I didn't know that I could call. I certainly couldn't go see him, but I didn't even know I could get information. He proceeded to take care of what he had to do, and 5 days later, I called this place because I had the name of it. I had called before, and I'd said, my husband is there, and they wouldn't tell me he was there. They would not say, yes, he is. You know, they wouldn't tell me. And I told him who he was. And so on the fifth day, I called and I said, my husband is there and his name is so-and-so and he's been there all these days and I'm going crazy. And I said, all I want you to tell me is he there? And they said, we need you to come here right now. So man, it was a Tuesday, I got in my car and I went. It was a Tuesday, June 5th. I got in my car and I drove up there and I was met by a lady who is in Al-Anon, but she is also a nurse and worked at this place, and she met me and she said, I need to have some time to talk to you. And she took me to a room and she sat down and she talked to me and she gave me Al-Anon. She talked to me about alcoholism, an alcoholic, the disease, and how it affected my life and what was wrong with me. And later she said, and now you can go see him. And when I saw him, he had no alcohol in his system, and he hadn't had for some days. And at that point, he had aged about 10 to 15 years when I saw him. That went away, but at that point, it was terrifying to me to see him. He was shaking. He couldn't walk without holding on to the walls, and it was a very frightening thing. She said, you can have dinner with him, but after dinner, he's going his way, and I'm taking you somewhere. Well, where she took me was to my first meeting of Al-Anon, and I continued to go to that Tuesday night meeting for 2 years. But she took me that night. She said, now he's going to AA, and you leave him there because they're going to take care of him, but we need to take care of you and your family. And Al-Anon is where that will happen. We walked down a hallway and I could hear laughter from this doorway. All this laughter going on, and I was sick. Oh, I was physically sick. I was emotionally sick. I was spiritually sick, but I was really sick. But anyway, she took me down and she left me at the door, but she walked in and she said, hi everybody, this is Dora, and she's new. And that's all she had to say. Man, they swarmed me like bees. They hugged me, you know. Oh, it's going to be okay, honey. Now, you come in, sit anywhere you want to. It's going to be all right. And in a few minutes, the meeting was called to order, and we had an Al-Anon meeting. Now, I heard shared last night that Nancy said that she couldn't remember anything that was said at the first meeting. I don't either. I cried through the whole hour, and I still felt hopeless because they're laughing. They're all laughing, and I'm not, and I think this can't help me. And we started the meeting, but I was sitting by the grace of God in front of the steps and traditions, and I looked up there, and I saw the word God, and I saw it more than one time, and I thought, well, these people do believe in God, and I've asked him for help, so maybe it'll work. And when I left that night, they said to me, keep coming back. And I took that. I didn't know they told everybody that, and I took that as Dora's personal invitation. And I said, okay, you know, they've invited me. I'm coming back. So I fell in love with that Tuesday night group and those people. And they gave me that night a newcomer's packet that I took home, but they gave me a gift that I couldn't hold in my hands, but it went straight to my heart, and it was hope. Hope that maybe we could be okay. Now, it was still weak because I was attached to him at the hip joint, and I stayed that way. Al-Anon didn't sever that for a long, long time, and when they did, it was with a great deal of love. But he got out real quick. He was not able to stay there over 10 days, and he got out real quick. And we started going to meetings together, and I shared Thursday night, had the privilege of sharing, that for 3 months I went with him to AA. At his invitation, which he said would have been his insistence, but it never got that far, but I went with him to open AA meetings and quickly learned about alcoholism and what it does to people and what it can do if you come to AA. And I got to tell you, I fell in love with the Alcoholics Anonymous people. I didn't qualify to be with you. Man, I loved you, though. And to release him to AA was the easiest thing in my life, because where we went, when we walked in, those people loved him, and they showed me they loved him. I saw them loving him, and I knew if he'll stay, we'll be okay. I still hadn't looked at my side of it, but we're going to be okay because they're going to work with him, and he'll never drink again. And I didn't know about putting that on one day at a time at that point. But anyway, where we went to AA, there was an Al-Anon meeting down the hall, and I would grace them with my presence once in a while in that 3 months. I would go in and give them an hour of my time, but I really wanted to be with, I love the alcoholics, and I wanted to be in their room. And I wanted to watch them love him back to health. See, I wanted to see all that. But eventually, I stayed long enough to hear. And the fog started lifting from my brain. And they started talking about focus on yourself. And, you know, I had to look at my home life. And I still had two children that did not like me. And they adored their dad. They didn't like me. And they weren't spending time with me still. And it broke my heart. God didn't give me those two children as a present for me to drive away from me. But my self-will did that. So I started hearing in my first year about looking at me and working the steps and getting someone to help you. And eventually I found a lady whose life paralleled mine, and I got a sponsor. And she got me busy in Al-Anon and away from AA so that I could really leave him alone and look at myself. And I came to Al-Anon to repair relationships. And that's exactly what has happened to me. I walked into my first meeting on June the 5th on a Tuesday night, and I have never, ever left. I've never taken a vacation. I've never been off for 2 weeks or off for a month. I've been in meetings with a sponsor, working the program, getting better, and making me what I want to be. I realized today when I got married at 17, I was not what I wanted to be. You know, I wasn't the best wife and the best mother and the best companion and the best friend. I was selfish, spoiled, self-centered, willful, spiteful, sullen when I wanted to be. You know, I got my way by using all those character defects. Al-Anon told me to try it a different way. So over my years in Al-Anon, in my recovery journey, I have learned all about me and how I don't have to be on the negative, I can be on the positive. Today, I work toward being a good mother, and I am today. A good wife, and I think I am. A good companion, and a precious friend to you, to all of you. Those of you I've met this weekend for the first time, I love you all, and I want to be your friend, and I want you to be my friend. Today, I'm likable. I know I'm lovable. I hope I'm likable to you. I like me, and that's important. I still today go to anywhere from 3 to 5 meetings per week, and I need to do that because I'm still working on these relationships I tore up. My son is 33, and he's the one I hurt the worst. He was the oldest, and he's the one I hurt the worst, and he's the one I've had to work the hardest on. And he's one that can't look me in the eyes even today and say to me, "I love you, Mom." He can't do that. He does it by email in Pensacola. We do it by email, but he cannot look me in the eyes today and say, "I love you, Mom." Now, I look him in the eyes and I say, "I love you." He can't say that back to me, but he can show me. My daughter says, "I love you," all the time, and my daughter lives in Japan, and that is not of my wishes, let me tell you. That was God's doing. 2 years ago, she graduated from FSU and applied to 30-some-odd universities in the United States of America, and she got a job in Japan. And God flew her across the ocean from this mother so that I genuinely could let her become a young woman. She came home last year for 7 days. She's coming home this year for 8. She emails us, and she loves us, and we know that. It hurts my heart that she's so far away. I want to be with her. I want to see her. I want to touch her, and I can't. I can email her. It's not the same. I can call her, and it's not the same. I can't touch her. But I get 8 days to do that in at the end of December. My son married his first girlfriend that he ever had in his life. He met her when he was 17 and married her when he was 24. They've been married almost 10 years. They have 3 children. They are the treasures of my life. I have an 8-year-old granddaughter, 4-year-old grandson, and 4-month-old grandson. God gave me these children as he was taking my daughter away. God gave me other things. I was sharing just a little bit about service work. When I was a year in the program, I was elected a group representative of my home group. It's always been my home group. I've never changed. They elected me their group representative, and a month later, the district I'm in also elected me their district representative. I didn't know what either one of those were, but I was willing to try. So I served for 3 years as a group representative and district representative and went to Montgomery, Alabama for assemblies. And everyone, service is not for everyone, but it was for me, and I fell in love with it. And I've done different things with the area. And as things have happened in my life, painful, I've had a new position of service that got me busy in thinking about Al-Anon instead of the problem. Every time it's happened that way, I've either gotten a new grandchild or I've gotten something that has directed me from the negative thing, because I live in life and life hurts. A lot of times life hurts. But anyway, service has been a band-aid for the pain, and it's also been a tremendous growth experience for me. And I just shared with just a few people here that right now I am serving the state of Alabama as their delegate. And everyone that I say that to says, how can you do that? You live in Florida. And it's true, but Florida has 2 delegates, Florida North and Florida South. But I'm that little bitty panhandle, and I can spit into Mobile, Alabama. So I represent the state of Alabama, and I have a hard time remembering that when I'm at conference and they do a roll call and they say Alabama, I just sit in my chair and wait for Florida. And then someone will better stand up, you know. So I do serve Alabama, and next year, the year 2000, will be my last year for that. But it has been my band-aid for life, and I've had a lot of hurting things in my life. I want to share one thing with you. Jerry said I was a pet lover, and I'm going to tell you just real quickly about this Dalmatian dog I have, and I need to tell you because it's important. 5 years ago, my son, when he got married, had left me his pointer bird dog because he had had her since she was a baby. She grew up on our land, and he took her home for one night, and she almost killed herself trying to get home. So the kind thing was he brought her home and gave her to Mama to raise, Mom and Daddy. And we raised her till she got old and she got sick, and the day came we had to let her go. And I did that, and my husband would have never let me done that by myself, but I took her to the vet, and the decision was made, and we did it right there. But I let this dog go, and my son saw this was coming, that we were going to have to let his old dog go, and it was going to break my heart, and he knew it. He went out and bought me a Dalmatian puppy weeks before we let the old dog go, and he kept this puppy at his house, and we were trying to get through Christmas. And it was going to be my Christmas present, was I was going to get this Dalmatian puppy. And I had a, 3-year-old granddaughter. That puppy ran all around their house for over 2 weeks, and I talked to her every day, and she never, ever told me there was a dog in her house, a Dalmatian for her grandmother. Never betrayed her daddy's secret. But the day came I had to let the old dog go, and it did break my heart. I mean, it killed me to hold that dog in my arms and let them put that dog to sleep. And I knew how bad it hurt my son, but I came home that evening and he called on the phone and he said, Mama, I know you're hurting and I'm going to come see you. And now this is the kid that can't say to me, I love you, Mother. But he said, I'm going to come see you, Mom, because I know that you're hurting. And I was crying and looking at a tree I couldn't decorate and presents I couldn't wrap and crying my heart out over this dog. Those of you that aren't a pet lover, this dog. My doorbell rang, and here is my son holding this baby Dalmatian with this huge bow around his neck and red collar. And he said, "Here, Mom, this will help." And he gave me this dog, and it is my love dog in my yard today. It's my 5-year-old love dog. When I feel like my son doesn't love me or I feel like we've had crosswords, I look outside at this dog, grown now, and there is my love from my son. He says, "Mom, this will help you." And he had had it for weeks. That was the best Christmas gift I got that whole year, was my love dog. And that dog has been an aggravation and an irritation and frustration. And if anyone has ever had a Dalmatian, they are stubborn, hard-headed, willful, just like me. And we can't, you know, I walk out there and that dog climbs up on me right up here with his front paws and he gives me a hug. And that is my love dog. My son loved me. And my son loves me, and I did a lot of harm to him. My little daughter flew off to Japan, and that was another time my heart broke. My heart has broken about 5 times in my 58 years. But the day I let my daughter go to Japan the first time was another heartbreak because we took her to Pensacola Airport. We put her on a 6:30 flight. It was 20-something degrees. The wind was blowing hard, hard, hard. And we stood outside that airport, and we watched the plane fly in the sky until it became a gnat, and I couldn't see it. And there went my daughter. There went my baby. And I knew that day I would not see her for 1 year, and I had never been away from her over 2 months, and she'd never been further than 4 hours from me. But there went my baby to Japan, and she fell in love with it, and she renewed a contract last year, and they flew her home. She got to come home 7 days. She went back. She's been there all of this year. She's coming December 30th for 8 days and go back again. And this is my baby. But you know, even though my heart broke, I want to tell you what happened. I got home that day, 6:30 in the morning, that plane flew away, and we got home about 7:20. I walked in my house, and this little red light was flashing on my answering machine. I had messages from Al-Anon members from everywhere, other states, because they knew I was hurting. The mailman that day brought a stack of cards that high from Al-Anon members saying, "Thinking of you, this too shall pass. We love you." And I went to a meeting that night and they just let me cry the whole hour. You know, they ignored me. They didn't stop a meeting for me. They just let me cry. But Al-Anon has been there for me through births. I've had Al-Anon members at the hospital when I've had grandchildren. Births, deaths. When I've experienced a death, I've had Al-Anon members hold me and say the Serenity Prayer with me when I've experienced personal deaths. Weddings, everything. Anything in my life that has been painful, Al-Anon and AA has been there to pick me and my husband up and carry us. So this is why I never raise my hand and say, "I'll come talk for you. Well, let me come talk for you." You will call me maybe and you'll say, "We would like for you to come to Mont Eagle and be our Al-Anon speaker. Would you be willing?" Yes, I'll be willing. It's not my favorite thing to do. It's not what I volunteer to do. I am willing because in this group this morning, I hope somebody has felt the way I felt. I hope somebody came in as confused and bewildered and scared as I did, but you can look at me now and say, "She's not that way now. I don't have to be that way forever." Because today, fear is not my constant companion. I'm not confused. I know about the disease of alcoholism and what it did to me. I understand. I know why my father committed suicide today, and nobody could tell me that before Al-Anon. I know why my precious uncle died in a hospital with double pneumonia. No one could explain that to me but AA and Al-Anon. So I come here today because you give me the answers, you give me your love, and you continue to give me hope, and then I try to give it back to you here. So I hope I was successful because this morning I prayed to God that He let me just tell you my name, my home group, and then He take over, and whatever He wished you to hear, you would hear from my mouth. That self-will would not be there because the story I would tell you, you wouldn't want to hear. You would want to hear God's story, and I hope that's what you heard. Please let me thank every single body sitting in this room today for the privilege and the honor of standing behind this podium and sharing with you from my heart. Thank you for listening. I know you're tired of sitting in the chairs now and would like to get up and move around. Just thank you for your courtesy. But most of all, please thank you for your love and for the hugs you've given me and you will continue to give me until we leave here at noon tomorrow. Thank you very much.